Okay, Niners, we are back with another video on App Compat, this time to talk specifically about MSI and installer issues. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, man?
I'm Robert Fleming. I'm the Windows Installer Program Manager. I worked on Windows Installer 4.0, which is in Windows Vista and Win2K server. I specifically worked on the UAC features and also worked on Logo.
Cool. And then also over here to help me fire off some questions, go ahead and introduce yourself again, man.
Hi, I'm Mark Taylor. I'm on the App Compat team, working over in the Building 20 labs for application compatibility with Server and Vista.
Cool. So let's go ahead and dive into this. MSI and installer issues, application compatibility issues.
Right. So the thing that Windows is increasing its investment in Windows Installer going forward. You can see that in the reappearance of Windows Installer in the Windows Client logo program, and the Windows Server for the first time has a requirement for Windows MSI in the Server logo. So the reason why we are emphasizing Windows Installer is that its integration with the OS has improved for Vista, and we feel that particularly with related to UAC, a very important feature in the Vista systems, that integration should motivate ISVs to want to use MSI. So we have a set of features there that are significantly differentiating a Vista-era application with a pre-Vista-era application, and that's where we spend a lot of time and focus. So the logo program with the UAC support it goes hand in hand.
Cool. So what are some issues if I'm looking at deploying my application as an ISV onto Windows Server 2008 or Vista? What are some MSI issues that I might run into with the legacy MSI?
So the one that everybody runs into is the custom actions that assumed that the user running the package would be an administrator. So if you haven't had the basics on UAC, the basics is UAC splits your token if you're an admin, and they have a protected admin mode. So even if you logged in as admin, you run as a standard user. And so when you want to get to the elevated state, what UAC does is they'll take either a prompt from a manifest or they'll detect via some of the heuristics on the way the shell executes code to put up a UAC prompt. So the UAC experience itself, at least with install, most apps were installing to admin locations. And because they're installing to admin locations, we had to do integration to get UAC to work, but part of the richness of Windows Installer is that custom actions are how you extend the Windows Installer. So we have two paradigms in terms of installation. We have the click once paradigm, which is we have a closed system, which you can do a very specific target set of features. And then we have the Windows Installer system, which is an open system, in which you can extend and you can get to other stores. So if you wanted to configure SQL or IS, Oracle, Apache, you could all do that with the Windows Installer with a sufficient amount of code. The problem with custom actions is that we have two forms of custom actions, one that runs as the user and one that runs as a local system. If you're running as user on Win2K3 or XP, and you were an admin, you would have had full rights as an admin. With Vista, we pulled all those rights away, or the Windows underlying OS pulled those rights away. And because of that, when you ran as user now, you only run as standard user. So if you needed to write to program files folder, or you need to write HKLM, you need to configure an OS service, none of that works via custom action. None of that works natively when you move to Vista or Win2K. So the trick is you need to write, the simple trick is that you need to flip the no impersonate bit on your custom actions, and that's the no impersonate bit is easy to find. Find your favorite search engine, look for no impersonate bit, and you'll find it. That usually fixes most problems. The one case it doesn't fix problems is where what your custom action did was both talk to the network and made per machine changes. And because we run as local system and local system doesn't have access to the network, you have to split, if that's your custom action, it needs to do both. You have to split your custom action into two pieces, one that talks to the network, marshals the data down, and then the piece that once you get the data marshaled onto the client machine, you can then have the administrator, the local system one, run the changes. So that's usually the worst case. There's one other case that bites people. We took away backup privilege, or SE backup privilege, from the custom action server. Some people were using that, so it's been a relatively rare case, but if you find that you need to configure Active Directory or do some really low-level things, SE backup privilege has hurt a few people. So those are sort of the laundry list and initial UAC issues. that aligns with what you've seen, Mark? Or
yeah, it pretty much does. There's a lot of custom action issues that we see in the lab, and most of the time we fix that by there's a tool called Orca, yeah, mixed up with the Visual Studio. But there's a tool called Orca that allows you to go in and kind of view the whole MSI database, and usually there's some basically binary values in there that you would change to map with some values in MSDN to do what you're talking about with a no impersonate bit. And so we end up doing that all the time with custom actions. The other thing that we see a lot is we talked about chaining of MSIs. A lot of times people will have two things. One, they'll have potentially MSIs calling other MSIs, what we call nested MSIs. And I'm sure you've got things to say about that.
Yep.
And then also we see MSI chaining happening. So where people have a number of components they have to install as part of one install package. And with UAC, because it prompts every time that you want to get admin privileges, so for every MSI package you'll get prompted by default, we see a lot of times people will try and chain these together, and they'll end up with however many packages they have. Each package will prompt the user. So obviously getting 10 prompts that say, are you sure you want to do this, isn't a great user experience. So Robert, Robert's worked out ways around this that we've talked to him about.
So the way you fix the chaining problem is that you digression in the history of Windows Installer. Windows Installer started as having a significant coupling to group policy as the distribution engine on the server side. So with group policy, there's this functionality called advertising. And what advertising does is writes your shortcuts, your COM registration, your extensions, so that if you click on one of those things, it can install it on demand. And one of the specific scenario that was designed for was, I'm a corporation who's locked down all my client desktops, and I don't want any of those clients to need admin rights to be able to elevate up and install software. So by advertising an application, you are the administrator is effectively telling the Windows Installer Engine, the administrator's blessed this application. So the essence of UAC in Windows Installer is to extend this blessing that historically has happened from group policy, which lives in Active Directory, down into a client-only experience, which the UAC credential prompt is that experience. So the way you get a chainer to fix this particular problem is that when you boot your first chainer, you want to have that one manifested run as a standard user. If it looks like setup.exe and you don't manifest it, installer detection will flip it. It will flip the UAC prompt. So you want to avoid that. You then have a second bootstrapper that you then have elevated, and that elevated bootstrapper does all the advertising for all your applications. So let's say you had three, you'd then advertise all those, and then you go back to your standard user bootstrapper, and then from that you'd invoke each of the packages, and you've effectively created the exact scenario that you have with group policy in a single UAC prompt, because that UAC prompt that you got when you did the when you went from the standard user chainer to the elevated chainer, that's the one that will show up, that will do all the work, and then your standard user, as per group policy since Win2K, gets all the pure user, or the lights up experience. It's, the machine's locked down, but you still get to install. For ISVs, what that means is you have to focus on adding, or you have to try your advertising scenario. And what we found historically in the Win2K context is that not a lot of ISVs were motivated to try group policy. Either they weren't a client app or they weren't a corporate app. But if you have a chainer scenario in which you want to have only one UAC prompt, then this is the best way to do it. And advertising is simple to use. It's the slash J switch on the command line. You can test it on your dev machine. It's not a lot of trouble. And usually it just works. The places where there's been some trouble, again, custom actions. So that's something that you have to focus on. But it's a debuggable problem, and it shouldn't take too much time.
So perhaps to back up and clarify some terminology here.
Yes.
For those developers out there, how about you go into what you mean by advertising?
Okay. Spooling into the back of my brain. Advertising is simply taking a portion of the Windows Installer definition. So Windows Installer is a declarative definition of your application. And with advertising, we take a very small portion of that and we write that very small portion into the system. And we effectively read the shortcut tables, assuming they're advertisable. There are non-advertised shortcuts. your extension table, if you've registered extensions via the table, and some of your comm goo, if you use the comm goo tables. And we write that as a seed. We basically say, here's some stuff that you should know about this application. And then what we do internally is we record the source location of that package. So when you hit that, any of those pointers, we go, oh, this is an advertised pointer. It's just a pointer to, it effectively resolves through our source resolution path. We go, oh, when I hit this path, I need to install. I hit the source path. I go pull down the MSI or the rest of the MSI and all its source files, and then I install it per the advertised experience. So it's really a two-phase deployment. And the goal there was is the goal in group policies context is just to introduce the idea that you have an application available to you. So the scenario in group policy was, let's say you're a manager and you only need Excel once every quarter because you need to do your budgets once every quarter, but otherwise you don't need Excel. So, but Outlook you need all the time. So what a group policy manager would do is, or the person managing your group policy would deploy Outlook by default, but they would put Excel in the advertised state, so it wouldn't come down by default. So that would save bandwidth on your network. It would save space in your hard drive. It would economize those that didn't need Excel. You know, everybody needs Outlook, but you might not need Excel. You might not need PowerPoint. So it would allow you to have this big SKU in which you had a lot of functionality available, but only the functionality you need would be on your machine. So sort of a differentiated experience for IT.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
So, quick question. Is that related to, at all, like if I'm installing Visual Studio or something, I might get the option at the end, do you want to install MSDN Express? Do you want to install SQL Express?
So that's chaining. Those options are chaining. Those options don't require advertising. Visual Studio could choose to do advertising, but as far as I know, they elevate their chainer at the first place, so they use a solar detection or they manifest to elevate their chainer, and then they install everything admin.
Gotcha.
The problem with that is that we have these personas we call Abby and Toby. If you elevate as and you get to the administrator context, we may not get your install may not get the user profile right when they go to write user profile stuff. So it's better to keep your user profile consistent, which is your standard user case, and then only elevate when it's necessary. So the benefit to using the Windows installer elevation is that we keep track of that and we get the user context correct. If you don't use, if you use the installer detection, that sometimes is messed up and you get Abby. So the scenario that is sometimes run into is I'm installing a game as a child and I get the UAC prompt and the parent comes by and this is server, but so this may not be relevant, but the parent comes in and provides a credential prompt and then the child runs the game as first boot. Then the child goes back to the game later and tries to boot it the first time. That first run of the game may not have been captured under the child's account. It may have been captured under the parent's account because when the parent provided the credentials, that was where the user profile went.
Gotcha.
So that's the scenario that is avoided when you use Windows Installer native elevation versus using installer protection. The chainer case in general is where you have multiple packages. So generally you're layering server case SQL Express or SQL, and you have an application that sits on top of that. Or if you're doing multi-tier, you may have a single machine that hosts SQL at one layer, IS another layer, and then a business tier. And when you deploy an application that's multi-tier on a single machine or you're deploying a stack of technologies, you get one MSI from one vendor, one MSI from another vendor. Or if you're a big company and you have multiple businesses, you get one part of your business may provide you one MSI, and they just want to test that, and this is good, solid. And then another part of your business may provide another MSI, and that part's solid. But it isn't until you put them together and add a bit of glue that the application lights up. So chaining in general is trying to solve that type of problem in the server context. In the client context, the most often there's two often cases. You may want to carry the .NET framework and then some little app on top of the .NET framework, and that's a chaining case. The other is your Office, and you're trying to be worldwide, and you have 100 languages that you want to support. The way that Office supports 100 languages is they have a language-neutral bottom SKU, and then on top of that language-neutral bottom SKU, they add languages packs. So language packs. So in North America, you have French, English, and Spanish. So an install for Office is the base SKU plus three language packs. So they have a chain of four MSIs.
Interesting.
So that's sort of how that comes together.
What's the reason that you don't want nested MSIs and that we're advising against that?
So the sordid history of nested MSIs. Nested MSIs were an extension of the upgrade feature originally put in. So going way back, back at the, sort of the start, the dawn of the prehistory of Windows Installer is that there at one time there was an OS installer and an app installer, and the app installer was called Acme. OS installer, clean machine, bare hard drive, just go fast. With an app installer, you're in a corporate, generally, we consider it a corporate scenario in which you have an existing app and you need to upgrade it. So it's a key scenario for application upgrades to go version to version to version, or application installs to go version to version to version. So with this upgrade functionality, which in the same transaction you install, you start the install of your newest product, and then it'll go and detect your old product, and at the same time as installing your new product, it'll pull off your old product. So you end up with one version, the latest version. So while we were writing that feature, which allowed you to couple two products, we went, oh, well, we could do a little custom action there that would support nesting that looked like upgrade. The problem is that almost nothing goes from the parent context to the nested context when you're doing that. And bad things happen, like you can't patch if you have a nested product. And given our, you know, this is, the original design was, you know, circa 1997. We have TWC, trustworthy computing now. We have an emphasis on security. And shipping things that you can't patch is verboten. So we tell people don't use nested installs. We have said it's deprecated in the SDK. We can pull it out of the engine because we don't want the app compat hit, because it would be particularly bad if sort of all these apps in the world just started breaking. So we leave it there, but we try to tell people don't use it. We've banned it in the logo program. So it's just one of those things that we know it has badness. What we recommend people do instead of nesting is chaining. And so the earlier conversations about chaining as a stack, whether it's chaining to upgrade and then chaining to upgrade or chaining to just first install, all of that is the preferred method of trying to stitch products together. Nesting is no longer preferred.
Speaking of patching, do you require elevation in Vista whenever you get these patches? Are there parts of MSI that leading question there?
Yes, that's I hadn't talked about that. So a key feature that we had in XP was the predecessor to UAC was Lua. And for the Lua feature, there was a game scenario. And the scenario was the earlier parent-child scenario where I'm a parent and I want to lock down my child's machine so that it doesn't get attacks by admin-targeted viruses. And so I put them in the LUA context. And the problem was that there are online games that if you provide patches, that will have patches on the cloud, and for you to continue to play the games that you want to play, Toby, the child, wants to play those games, he has to apply the patch. Otherwise, the client server is out of sync and the game won't work. So in XP, we had this feature that allowed a game publisher to provide on their server a patch that would then apply. And we had this coupling via certificate that allowed the proxy that you got rights as an admin when your parents put in the original credentials, that proxy would happen via the credentials and we would elevate. So Lua comes along after we've implemented this functionality in XP, and it's the exact same scenario. It's you have a...
Or UAC now.
That's right, sorry.
We used to call it Lua.
Lua is the old name, UAC is the new official name. So, yeah, that's right, I should change context. So in Vista and UAC... We found it also the common case that in corporations or in client systems where you've had an administrator apply a product to your machine, you don't want the barrier of having the administrator distribute a patch. So what you actually want to be able to do is say, I have a security patch. If the user wants to install it, a standard user, then you sign the patch with one certificate. The MSI contains another certificate, and it just works. We have details about how it works online. The effective thing that an ISV has to do is they have to include a certificate in their original MSI, and they have to sign all their patches. And what we found with Logo, and I don't know if you see this very often, but we found with Logo, as we said, in Logo, sign everything. And there's actually been a significant amount of challenge to try to get sign everything to in practice. And the largest reason that people have problems signing everything is that they have dependencies in their code. So I may have gotten code shareware, I may have gotten it from a partner, from a business that doesn't exist anymore, and I, as the ISV, don't want to sign somebody else's code. So we have this tail, this relatively long tail, about trying to get everybody to get in the discipline of signing their code so that we know who owns it and therefore we can trust it. Over time, if the system locks itself down further or tries to create more intelligence around the way it's locked down, signing is going to be a critical piece of that. So going forward, if you're looking at the next version of Windows or you're looking about how Windows is going to go over the long term, signing is going to be a critical piece as we go forward.
Well, just like with drivers on 64-bit, they have to be signed.
Absolutely. And you know, we don't want to be too aggressive too early. Compatibility goes to hell if we're too aggressive too early, but we need to increase the ISV discipline over time. So it's the carrot and stick. Logo is a carrot, and 64-bit drivers is a stick,
mm-hmm.
right? Can you even install without signing on 64-bit? I didn't think so.
Not for drivers.
Right.
No.
So, and then, you know, 64-bit has the 16-bit issue as well, which, you know, we haven't seen very often, but I imagine you see in the app compatible application.
It's funny because a lot of times the example that we always use are old pieces of installers that are 16-bit.
Yes.
So that's what usually gets, if there is 16-bit, a lot of times it's install code. So, it's funny.
Yeah, I actually came across it recently from Microsoft IT where I run 64-bit Vista, and they tried to push down a patch to my machine that was 16-bit.
Yes.
And you're just like, no, that's not going to work.
So what's important, that's actually an important point. One of the things that Windows Installer does as a part of the ecosystem is we, Microsoft, don't invest deeply in the tools required to produce packages and patches. We invest in the underlying technology, but the end-to-end user experience is really determined by our tools vendors. So, Install Shield, Wise, Wix, InstallAware, all of those vendors and their innovations to try and bring a reasonable user experience to install is important. So if you have a 5 or 6 year old version of your packaging tools, it might be a good time to upgrade and think about, you know, the tools that are built to work with Vista or Win2K8 server context. They're smarter, they're higher quality. Some people complain they're expensive, but for the pain relief that you'll get over time, $300 for a packaging tool isn't bad. It'll save you a lot of headaches. So, you know, look at your tools, make sure your tools are up to date. 16 bits, if you're running on 64, is one. Custom actions, UAC prompts, it was infrequent that they worried about in the past. And now they're aware of it, they've updated their tools, it's the right thing to do. Another thing that we run into with, another feature that we spent quite a bit of time on with Windows Vista and with Server is Restart Manager. So reboots, and in particular reboots in the data center, are bad. So one of the things that you can do with the Windows Installer is you can support Restart Manager. And what Restart Manager does is it's Uber files in use, for those of you that know Windows Installer from the past. So it is able to scan services, which wasn't able to scan before. It's able to scan quick taskbar items. So with that support, your package needs to sort of opt into it. And the way that you opt into it is you put in Restart Manager dialogs, and we actually have in the logo program a requirement, both Restart Manager support in your app and Restart Manager support in your setup. What Restart Manager looks like in your setup beyond the dialog is just that when we see that you have Restart Manager support, we call Restart Manager, they pull the files in use based on what we're carrying in the package. If they see that it's anything used, they'll try to shut your app down. And when they shut your app down, they'll then boot it back up. So if you have running apps, so the really cool demo is Outlook, at least for the client, is Outlook or Word, where you went home without thinking about saving. You know, they auto-saved, but you come back and you didn't know that you were patched, even though they mm-hmm. had to apply a patch for Office. What you need to do in your app, and I don't know how often you advocate this, but you have to, there's a new message that you get from the Restart Manager that says, we're about to shut you down. And it looks like a shutdown message, like the OS was going to shut down, but I think it's the LPRAM. I haven't talked about this in a while. I think it's the LPRAM actually distinguishes between you're getting a Restart Manager message and you're getting a full shutdown. There's a behavior called freeze dry that we encourage people to do. And what freeze dry does is it takes your current active state that's in memory, writes it to disk, and then you actually also write to the Restart Manager call. The API should call you back on. So they'll shut you down. You save your data, they'll shut you down. They'll call you back with your command line. When you get that command line, you should tell yourself, oh, go get the data off disk, and then you can boot back up and you can be the exact same state.
So is this a tool that's out there, this ability to basically persist all my memory, or is this something I'm writing as an ISV?
It's something that you have to write.
All right.
So it's so custom. In the fullness of time, what Windows would have would be a state management tool in which you were keeping, ISV would be keeping their state in our state engine, and it would just be available to you when you asked. That's a ways from being done universally. You know, different apps have done that solution in different ways, so it's really a custom tool right now. We don't have a universal solution for state.
Cool. So with Restart Manager, of course, I assume I can also use the same API to kind of issue checkpoints in my application when a user's using it to say if they're on step 4 of step 8. And if my application for some reason crashes, you know, you would hope in a perfect world on Windows an application would never crash, but
Right. Sometimes
it happens, then you can automatically restart myself from step 4 rather than requiring the user to start from scratch.
So there's two cases there. There's running install and there's running the application.
Mm-hmm.
Running the application case, I have seen crash recovery, but I don't know how it's done. I know that Office has it. I just don't know whether Word is particularly tied in. Oops, sorry. Other side.
Joys of working in an office.
Yeah, since we mainly work with the apps that are trying to get the old apps that are broken to work.
Right.
We're not so much on there's a whole other team, that the light up team that did light up events and things, that worries about trying to get all the new functionality
right.
features in. So,
gotcha.
Right. So Restart Manager is in that bucket.
That. Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
But even playing into the installer issue, if I'm leveraging Restart Manager, then my installer can actually have the application automatically shut down, patch
Correct.
It and update it, and
Correct.
Restart.
The one edge there that's a little fuzzy is if you did a chainer and each time you were updating the same app, then Restart Manager would shut it down and bring it up and shut it down and bring it up. We don't find
mm-hmm.
that's often the case. And if that was your case, Restart Manager actually has APIs that in your chainer you can wrap the experience and say, I know these files are likely to be in loose, so shut them down. I'm going to do a whole bunch of work, and then I can bring them back up in the chainer. So it's not just the Windows installer, but you can also do it in the chain, which also means you could do it in your app as well if it was important to your app. What else do we have on the list?
So any other common issues, or does that kind of wrap it up that we run into?
Well, some ISVs wonder about, oftentimes with UAC, wonder about if they've got an app that they can install, say, into just the user's folders and just the current user directory. Whether there's a way to support that with the MSI installer, if they're like wanting to certify or whatever.
Right. So there's two ways to get per user to function within the logo. One is to do per user via ClickOnce, which is particularly tailored to manage code, and they can run in isolation. If you need to do a per user app, so the most common per user app is something that does a communication with the server, where you want a really ubiquitous client. So that you can talk to a server. So Live Meeting, Windows Messenger, or Live Messenger, Office Communicator, any of the other competitors to those products want to have a ubiquitous client, and so that you can talk to the server. So they installed it per user, one, because they that allows them to get beyond the UAC prompts. They have to worry about admins. They don't have to worry about parents. And the other thing is that they're not worried about licensing on the client, because all their value is actually in the cloud. So they don't have to worry so much about tampering, because you can do tamper-proof. You have to do tamper-proofing on the server anyway, so you sort of leverage that. So the way that you support that in the Windows installer is that we have a bit on the summary information stream, very low-level information. You can find the documentation online, in which you say your package is Lua-aware. And the Lua-aware bit just tells us not to throw the UAC prompt. In your app, you have to go do the – or sorry, your app install, you have to go do the work that installs it to a per-user location, and that's usually app local data, if I remember correctly. And what that does is it puts it in your non-roaming user profile, and you can pick a path under there and put your app there. If you want to do roaming with Windows Installer, you can do that well as well, but ClickOnce, you can't do roaming. And effectively what you're trying to get done in those cases is you're just trying to get a ubiquitous experience. The things to be aware of... if you're running servicing and you're in an IT org and you need to run servicing on a per-user instance, you have to boot into each user profile to service that app. So that puts an additional burden on your servicing infrastructure to be able to get that right. That's generally why most ISVs choose to be per-machine, is that they want a single servicing instance, a single instance of the binaries. Because the other thing that you run into if you have per-user is you run into having many instances of the app, which eats up hard drive space and it has other sort of negative connotations. There's a trade-off, though. There are a number of apps, the ubiquitous clients for a cloud, that want to use that, and that's generally what I see them. So if you were running database tools, I don't see any reason you need the database tools themselves to be per machine other than SQL instancing. Because they have to connect to the cloud, and you can manage that password relationship otherwise. So does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Boy, can't think of anything else.
So does that basically wrap it up, folks?
It covers what we see most of the time in the lab, I think.
Well, that's good, because you guys run a good amount of labs and see a lot of ISV applications.
Right.
So I'd imagine these are going to be the top issues that you might run into as an ISV.
Custom actions, that's probably the top issue. Yeah. Chainers would be second, and then all the rest sort of... The funny thing about apps is you have such a wide spectrum of apps that show up in the lab. You know, you have some very small apps, you have some very big apps. So, you know, it's hard to predict for each app the exact recipe, but I think those are the two biggest ones. Fair?
Cool. Well, thanks, guys. And thanks for your time for shooting the Channel 9 video.
Thank you.